Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hi, I'm Caroline O'Donoghue, the host of Sentimental Garbage, and welcome to the bonus episode of my interview with Ava Rice, the author of The Lost Art of Keeping Secrets. If you haven't listened to my chat with Lauren Bravo about the book yet, maybe go back and listen so you get the full 360-degree experience. Here's my full conversation with Ava, in which we discuss Take That, pony books, and bad, bad book covers. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us about this absolute jewel of a book.
Thank you.
Honestly, I said this in the main episode as well, but I have no qualms about saying it again, and looking like a total kiss arse, which is, I think it's one of the best written novels of the 21st century.
And oh my gosh, I'll take that any day of the week. Thank you so much.
In terms of the range of emotions I felt while reading it, from like sort of intense sort of nostalgia, but also this thing of, what I loved so much about it is that the 50s are this incredible in-between time, and that often get washed over as just being either a precursor to the 60s or just this kind of hangover from the war. And what's so interesting is that you have got these characters who are in this transition period of their own.
Yeah.
They're in this kind of, they're not quite adult, not a girl, not yet a woman sort of scenario.
Yeah.
And so you've got like these transitionary characters within this transitionary part of the history.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear more on how you came up with that sort of.
Well, that was it. What you've just talked about there was exactly what I was trying to nail in terms of the geography of the book, in a way, because I always found periods before great periods of change, just on the cusp of that bit, to be almost more exciting than the actual point of change itself. So, in other words, what got me started with this in the first place was the musical element. When I first had the idea for this novel, I didn't want to write about an England that was already aware of Elvis, for example. Mm-hmm. I wanted to write about an England that was waiting for the next great thing to happen. But they didn't know what that was going to happen. And particularly these kids who were 16, 17, 18, they weren't even called teenagers. The term hadn't even been coined at that point in history. Mm. They were basically expected to go directly from school into an adulthood that they only knew of through their parents, really. So this whole movement, this sense of something uprising post-war, was incredibly exciting to me, because it felt like they were the first people to do it, really, in that sense. They were the first real proper generation that could call themselves teenagers. They were the people who were taking the rules and smashing them up. And when I started researching the book, what was so interesting was that there were a lot of characters who were obliterated by the arrival of Elvis. A lot of people who saw, as soon as Elvis is seen as your year dot, you wipe out a lot of stuff that was happening in the really interesting period just before he emerged. And I decided quite early on that I wanted to make Johnny Ray a character in the book. He's a real person. He existed. But nobody really knew who he was. When I started asking my friends, have you ever heard of Johnny Ray? The only knowledge people had of him was through the Dexys Midnight Runners song, Come on Eileen.
Poor old Johnny Ray.
Poor old Johnny Ray. Sounded sad on the radio, broken million hearts in mono. And that song, the first verse of that song is all about Kevin Rowland, the lead singer of Dexys, his mum, and her obsession with the singer Johnny Ray in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And I asked my dad about him and about people of that generation about Johnny Ray, and it came to light that there was this huge pop star at that time who was able to whip women into young girls into an absolute frenzy when they came to see him play. But when Elvis came along, he was kind of the John the Baptist, I guess, to Elvis. And when Elvis came along, everyone before him was sort of wiped out. But I like the idea of taking the sense of the movement uprising rather than it peaking. And Johnny Ray seemed to be the kind of pop star epitome of this.
Yeah.
And having writing about kids who were absolutely on the brink, but not yet at the point where they knew what was going to happen next, because everything was post-war, rationing hadn't even ended in 1955, mm-hmm. 54. So it felt to me like a really exciting time, because in a weird way, being in the kind of post-war no man's land felt like a really exciting starting point for a story.
Yeah.
Because everyone can write, you can always write about Elvis, you can always write about, you know, a post-rock and roll London, or a London that is experiencing rock and roll for the first time. But what about that little bit that happened just before that? That was really exciting to me.
And so did this decision to write in this period come first, and the decision to have these girls on the crux of this kind of womanhood come second, the characters come second?
My major influences in this book, I'd read a lot of Nancy Mitford, which is fairly obvious from, you know, and Dodie Smith.
In a delightful and in no way annoying way, you know?
Oh, well, it's
lovely. It
doesn't
feel like you're aping
that.
Her so much as a tribute. And there is a bit where somebody says, well, if you want to hear about books, then wait till Nancy gets here. And I love to think that's the Nancy.
Oh, absolutely. I, that's one of my most fun things about being a writer, is dropping real names into the story, which I kind of gave myself license to do with this book, and with everything else I've written actually post this. But the decision to have the 17-year-olds was because I feel like, for me in my life, I felt like that 17-18 was such a key moment. It's such an important time in any girl's life. And to have that happening at the same time as a huge change in cultural shift in this time period felt really exciting. And my other major influence was a writer called Ruby Ferguson, who wrote...
Have you heard of her?
Well, you should definitely check her out. She wrote a lot of children's stories. She wrote a lot of pony books about girls and ponies in the 50s. And
I was sort of obsessed with the most soothing genre of book.
Oh, the absolute, absolute best. And I went back to her books, weirdly, in my early 20s, because I wanted to kind of see whether they stood the test of time and they were still great. And I read practically all of them in one sitting, and I just thought, this woman, her style of writing was so amazing and so funny, and her dialogue was so great, and you could still love them as an adult. And I set off with the first page of Lost Art. I actually stole a sentence from the first page of Jill's Gymkhana, one of Ruby Ferguson's books. And
what was the sentence?
It's only a short bit. It's when she goes, "Just look at that sentence!" Exclamation mark.
I love that bit. Yeah.
And that was a direct nick from Ruby Ferguson. But I let the characters in those books in her Jill series really influence Charlotte and Penelope. And she's and I actually acknowledge her at the beginning of the book as well, because I felt like so much of what I wrote was so based on that style, that incredibly optimistic, effervescent, energetic, pre-rock and roll but post-war thing that was going on, and about being a teenager at that point. She was a massive influence on this book.
Because in many ways, it feels as though you do begin with a kind of a very jolly hockey sticks sort of vision of Charlotte and Penelope and who they are. And I hadn't read this book before Lauren Bravo told me to read it as her request for her assignment. And so it was a joy. And when I first got into it, I was like, oh, this is a lovely, soothing read. And then I hit Julie in the Loaf. I was like, oh no. this is something different altogether. This is like an eccentric, strange, but incredibly tender book. And I think actually the moment where I knew it had, I mean, Julie and the Loaf was when it had my like brain.
I love that you love that, because I when I was at boarding school, I had this weird, I don't know what, I mean, obviously I was desperately seeking attention at the time, but I decided to keep making myself sound insane, keep a loaf of bread in a cage.
You did not.
I did, I swear. I mean, I'm literally making myself sound bonkers.
This is the most like bonkers posh girl story of boarding
Complete,
school ever. I
know,
love it.
And I'm aware of the fact that, that exactly it underlines all of that stuff in blazing technicolor, but I felt like for a few days it was obviously some kind of attention seeking thing that I was like, oh, right. Eva's keeping a loaf of bread in a cage called Julian, and I thought,
literally called Julian.
Yeah,
fabulous.
And then I sort of lost interest in it, after that, and decided that it was a sign of some form of insanity. but I remember thinking with Harry. The character of Harry was so fun, because I could kind of create my dream boy as a teenager.
Like, and he is very much a dream boy.
Who would I have really fancied when I was 17, and why? And by making him, eccentric and brilliant at magic, and looking a tiny bit like, I always imagine him looking a bit like a kind of damaged David Bowie, with the kind of, because of his different colour
eyes.
And being, being sort of slightly tormented by the wrong love. And I absolutely love him, because he sort of represented no boy that I had ever come across or ever did when I was a teenager, but he was sort of like a manifestation of all the boys I kind of wanted to meet and wanted to find.
And the kind of boy that you might get in a pony book as well, you know?
Absolutely, yes.
Strange and appears and disappears. And...
Yes, and there's just the element of magic was a real deliberate thing to have this this sort of... When Penelope initially meets Charlotte, she feels as if she's stepping into a world that is slightly magic. She can't quite put her finger on how and why. And so Harry, being a magician, was sort of an actual real-life representation of this sense of her falling into this sort of magical... world.
Right.
But equally, I wanted to have Charlotte falling into Penelope's world as well, so that she's drawn in by Milton Magna and Penelope's drawn in by Charlotte and Harry, and they're both getting something huge from each other, which I think the female friendship thing was also something I really wanted to explore in this book, because having gone to boarding school and having had these incredibly intense female friendships during my teens, what I wanted to get across in this book was that a lot of the time, even though you're talking about boys and you're talking about men, or you know, and kind of how Penelope feels when she first meets Rocky, for example, the person she really wants to be with is Charlotte. The person she really wants to talk to is Charlotte. The person who she wants to impress and the person who she wants to think the most of her is Charlotte. And it's not until right at the end, when they've both grown up a bit, that she can understand her feelings for Harry. But Charlotte is the kind of... She's the lightning bolt, more than anyone else.
It's almost like she's having adventures so she can tell Charlotte about them later.
Yes, exactly, yes. And there is that sort of undercurrent of something more, and it's not sexual, but it isn't not sexual, if you see what I mean? It's like, it's got a weird... there's something sort of unspoken about those friendships, when especially at this time in the 50s, but about the intensity of them. And I wanted to get that across, but also show how, when men come into this situation, how it alters it and how it affects that.
I had thought at various points of the novel that there are many characters and scenarios that you could read as queer. And I think Inigo is a great example of that. I think there's Inigo.
Yes.
Sorry.
No. I love the fact that actually, because Talitha, lots of people pronounce as Talitha, which is another pronunciation of the name.
Yeah.
But I always wanted it to be Talitha.
Okay.
There was a very beautiful girl with me at school a couple of years above. I've never said this actually.
Really?
She probably wouldn't remember me, because she was a couple of years above me. And I always remember thinking she was kind of the person I had in my head with that character. But yeah, and it's weird because that you said that, because the book I wrote after this, which is about Inigo, and it's sort of about him and what happens to him. There was quite a lot of that sense of repression in that sense. Inigo, he had to represent something completely different in this book to what the girls are representing, because he was representing the looking towards America and the single-minded obsession that he had with music. And even though he's quite a minor character in this book, he was so important to me because he was ultimately outward looking, and I love the idea of bringing in a character, his uncle Luke, who could bring back Elvis records before anyone had heard of Elvis. And I sort of love this idea of somebody, you know, in a huge house in the middle of Wiltshire, actually having one of the first copies of one of Elvis's songs and being able to listen to them on, you know, on vinyl, and going, what is this? And him being the only person who really gets it.
And I suppose maybe it's unfair of me. Maybe that's why I presumed that there is a kind of inherent queerness to the character, because you often get that in novels where the queer character is the first, is sort of the tastemaker and sort of the person who sees the potential, who sees the spark before anybody else can.
Yeah.
Something a little bit subversive about him that way.
Completely, and I wanted him to be subversive. I was never kind of clear about him in that sense particularly, but I wanted him to be... I wanted him to be quite radical and quite... I wanted him to have opposite views to his sister, and to view her kind of crush on Johnny Ray to be, you know, irrelevant compared to what was to come. And the fact that Elvis was just this earthquake that he could see happening, he could feel happening. And it's almost like the girls think that they know it all, the girls think that they're, you know, so forward-thinking, but actually he is the one going, just wait, you don't know what's going to happen next.
I completely adore that the girls, they never apologise for Johnny Ray. And they, people take the piss out of them throughout the book.
No, but that's just Me and Take That. And all the bands that I loved when I mean, Take That are now very credible in terms of the fact that they've, you know, they kind of came full circle when they reformed and everyone realised they were great. But I spent a lot of time in my teenage years being absolutely obsessed by, you know, a reasonably early Take That. Mm. And people around me going, what, you know, why aren't you listening to whatever else was called at the time? I'm trying to think, sort of, I don't know, maybe it was kind of the Stone Roses, James, that kind of era. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so in fact, the Johnny Ray teen obsession aspect of it was one of my most fun things to do. And I found a woman online who'd been to see Johnny Ray in concert, and I had a, you know, an email exchange with her about how it felt. There was also a brilliant book which is called What Bambaloo Bam, What Bamboo One, something like that. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this brilliant book about pop. And what is in, what was interesting when I was researching this whole period was the anarchy, because when the 50s are presented, particularly on TV or in film, everyone's quite pristine and it's all quite sort of, you know,
little skirts and
and quite sweet. And actually, if you delve into it, what was happening? Cinemas were being ripped apart when people were watching Blackboard Jungle. People were at the Teds were terrifying. You know, they're walking around with knives. They were the gang culture was rife. It was a lot more violent than people imagined. And in the same way that when people were going to see Johnny Ray, people weren't just sort of sitting there, you know, meekly waiting for this guy to come on. They were absolutely losing their shit. They were going ballistic because here was the guy who they're obsessed by. They were in full fledged teenage hysteria at this man, and he was known as the nabob of sob because he cried all the time on stage. And his whole thing was he whipped people into an absolute frenzy through his own emotion. He was kind of Mr. Emotion, and he wore hearing aids because he lost his hearing as a child. And he was gay and was, you know, obviously never spoke about it at the time, but he, and was a massive influence on Morrissey and on a lot of other, you know, subsequent pop stars who you wouldn't kind of imagine, but because of this, and he came over to England, which was also quite rare at the time for an American pop star to come over, but he really, really was one of the first guys to get people into absolute hysteria. And when I wrote about that, I was thinking about how, you know, going to see Take That, and it was such an important thing for me to have these guys who I could plug into, who I knew I was never going to get, and yet the, you know, the thought of the potential of getting them was so important. It was such an important thing for me at that time to have a kind of destination to be working towards when it came to men or boys or something. Was just, you know, they were kind of the ultimate. It didn't matter what they were just.
Didn't matter which one. Did you have one?
I always I loved Robbie, and then he left, and then I loved Gary, and and Gary is ridiculously, he's now my friend. I know him.
No.
Yes, I do. It's ridiculous, and I still have to kind of pinch myself when I sort of see Gary, and he goes, comes up and says hello. I'm kind of, oh my god, can this be happening to me? But I loved that because I was obsessed by pop music as a teenager, absolutely obsessed, and it drove a lot of what I did outside of school, you know, going to see bands and kind of poring over copies of smash hits and reading the lyrics to songs. And I was a proper pop music obsessive. So I wanted to bring that in a way where I could investigate how early pop was sort of, and no one thought pop was going to last.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
And did you have a moment where, because one of the sort of journey I'm going on with this sort of genre of book is that everybody, almost every woman I know, learns how to do her adult reading through women's fiction that they pick up that belongs to their mother, and they sort of read, they read the Marion Keys or the Judy Coopers or what have you, and then that's how they learn how to read grown up books.
Yeah.
And then generally when they're about 14 or 15, a boy comes along and tells them they should be reading Kerouac.
You know what you say to the boy at that point.
Yeah.
You say, go away and read I Capture the Castle, then come back to me and tell you know anything about girls.
But I don't think girls have the confidence to do that.
They don't, but my brother said something to me the other day. My brother's 2 years younger than me, and he said to me, and it was a hilarious conversation, he said to me, I just think that every teenage boy should be given a copy of I Capture the Castle, because you learn more about girls in that book than you ever would through anything else.
Yeah.
And they're missing a trick, these boys,
because
it's all in there. And frankly, yeah, the idea, I mean, yeah, of course, boys, you know, sort of sending you music that they think you're going to like, I mean, in my case, I don't know, say Led Zeppelin, I could never quite be my absolute jam. Whereas, you know, obviously a great band, but I was always sort of slightly embarrassed about the fact that I would rather be listening to Madonna at that point. and you know, and but I feel like the whole thing of what you can get out of books as a, it's almost like as a young girl, and if you're being told to read stuff, you're so malleable, you're so influenced by, if it's someone who you happen to think is great just telling you to read something, yeah, you're kind of going, oh my god, I should love this.
I have a really problematic relationship with James Joyce, because when I was about 17, I was reading Peter S. Beale's The Last Unicorn, which is the most beautiful fantasy novel ever, I think.
It's absolutely brilliant.
It's gorgeous. And there was the other boy in my class who sort of wanted to be a writer, and we had kind of a friendly rivalry thing.
Yeah.
Just sort of like sat next to me on the bus and sort of gave me this look, you know, the kind of penetrating look, and just got Ulysses out of his pocket.
Oh,
and
no.
I was like, oh, fuck off.
No, oh my gosh, that's absolutely unacceptable. I would have said at the point, I mean, because I quite often get asked who my favourite writers are, and I always say, I mean, it's such a difficult one, but in terms of the sheer pleasure that they've given me, I would say Jilly Cooper, D.H. Lawrence, and Sue Townsend, and I just would find it, because in terms of the, you know, the honest bookshelf, like the one where you actually have the books that you really, really, really want to read, those three, and of course, you know, Stella Gibbons, Daphne du Maurier, the absolute godmothers of all this stuff.
I feel like people, they like to attach a worthiness to du Maurier. They like to make her seem like she's more difficult
absolutely
to do than she is.
Yes.
And same with Patricia Highsmith as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, these are like page-turning thrillers and romances.
But it's so much more difficult to do that than it is to do anything worthy. I mean, it's so much more difficult to do something brilliantly commercial than it is to do something, you know, that's brilliantly reviewed by kind of cultish papers and stuff.
Yeah.
The thing that's really hard to do is to be popular and brilliant. I mean, and you don't have to be original, you just have to be good. Mm. Like, you know, nothing you do has to be a story that no one's ever told before. You can tell the same story a million times, but if it's good, then that's all that matters. And it's hard.
So
it's really
hard. This book became, it's fair to say, a phenomenon. I'm sure people talk to you about it all the time still.
And well,
you written, what, 12 years ago?
I guess 11, 12 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. And so I'd love to talk about the packaging and the marketing, because, I mean, to me, this cover is a little bit deceptive. And the illustrations are a little bit deceptive.
But what
makes me think is that when I got, you know, a quarter into it, and I was like, oh my god, I think I might have found one of my favourite books. How lovely.
Yeah.
And then every time I came across an illustration, I was like, who are they marketing this to? And it just seemed like someone really believed in it, and they wanted as many people to see it as possible.
That's exactly what happened. And I kind of let myself be guided by the team who worked on the book, who were absolutely brilliant. George Moore at Headline was amazing.
She's a legend.
She's a complete legend. And my editor, Harriet Evans, they were so convinced by it. I mean, in a way that, you know, half the time I'd be kind of tearing my hair out going, oh my god, I've just plagiarised Ruby Ferguson and I don't like it. And, you know, the kind of depressing thoughts you have about writing when you're trying to write. And they were so convinced by the cover and by the illustrations and by how it should be done that I went, great, let's just go along with it. And it worked. But I have to say that it probably wouldn't have been what I would have chosen myself for the cover, but what they did absolutely worked.
Did you have sort of an idea in your head of what the cover would look like, and then you were like, oh.
I think everyone has...
I'm not saying it's a bad cover, by the way.
This is actually the cover of the reprint, but the original one's got more of the cartoony cover of the... I feel like titles and covers are such a minefield as far as I'm concerned, because, briefly to touch upon this, one thing that I find unbelievably irritating is the sort of catch-all thing that I think often publishers... Or it's not even their fault. I think it comes from supermarkets. It comes from, the people they're trying to sell the books to, who are thinking, if we put a girl half looking at the camera and a handbag and a flower and a house in the background, then this book's going to sell because that's what women want to read. Whereas if you're a David Nichols or a Nick Hornby and you're really writing for women, I mean, a lot of these guys are writing for women, you're going to get away with a very, very cool... sort of
One Day was a very striking cover.
One Day was a brilliant cover, but
commercial women's fiction.
I cannot believe that he would have got that cover if he was a woman. I just don't believe that he would have done.
Yeah.
Because I think that if you're a woman, it's that thing of I saw some covers for my last book, my book that came out a few years ago, the original covers that were done for that, and it was the most upsetting thing I've ever seen, because they just kind of put a meadow scene, a picnic basket. And I was like, when are they ever in a meadow? When are they having a picnic? And kind of two champagne glasses.
Right.
And I really, really find the covers and titles thing very stressful. But I've realised over the years that the way to do it is to go in with your own ideas and say this, and actually physically to take ideas in.
Mm.
And if you've got people who like George, who understood what we were trying to do with this book, I always felt like this book was almost on the verge of being a YA book, as in it kind of would have been okay in that section of the shop.
Mm.
But they rightly realised that they could cast the net wider than that.
Because teenagers ended up reading it anyway.
Because teenagers exactly ended up reading it. But I feel like I think you always have covers in your head, and then it's hard not to look at the first cover that's presented to you and go, oh, that's not quite how
I
imagine it.
I definitely had that moment.
Yeah,
because my cover has a large rose on it.
Yeah,
and which is in keeping with the tone of the book and everything. But I had this moment where you always want to know what your first ever book is going to look like, and you have all these aspersions of the kind of author you're going to be, and then you see it, and no matter what it is, you have that moment of, oh, I think I'm going to be sick.
I absolutely, and all the fonts weird, and the blurb is another massive problem.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, writing blurbs, and just if you ever leave anyone else to write a blurb, it's always a mistake. You just have to just do it yourself, and it's that real thing of just thinking, right, I'm not. You have to be in absolute control of as much as you can of it as possible. Because, you know, it's so easy for things to slip through the net. And weirdly, when I was writing Lost Art, I was pregnant, and I had my daughter early. She was 5 weeks early, and I was supposed to be finishing an edit, and I was kind of editing as in a proofreading and stuff. And I was able to kind of get back to it after I'd had her, but I slightly took my eye off the ball. And there were a couple of things that slipped up that I was so cross with myself about. Like, at one point I mentioned After Eights, and then on Amazon about sort of five people pointed out that After Eights hadn't actually come out in 1994.
Right, right.
And there's a part of you that just goes, shut up!
But God also, sake. God, you're right!
Yeah, exactly, but that's so annoying!
Totally.
And I'm quite slapdash as a person, as in I'm quite kind of like, let's just get it done, and then, you know, we'll work on it after, you know, then we'll fine-tune it sort of thing. And this book, because of it being set in such a specific time frame, I had to be quite detailed with it and really go through it and think, would they have worn that? Would they have been able to use that expression? You know, would she have said that? Would that have been actually something you would say in that year?
That strikes me as being an incredibly stressful part
of
writing.
It was really quite hard. But on the other hand, the thing that I love about it is that you don't have to bother with phones, the internet, and stuff that just obliterates plot.
They really do. They explode it.
And you know, before you know it, I mean, Talitha could have looked up all kinds of things about Aunt Claire. There are so many things that would have been ruined by setting this book at any other time.
I really want to talk about, just to go back to the plot briefly, about the Aunt Claire Talitha thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that bit takes people by surprise a little bit.
Yes.
It's basically the titular secret. Do you
know
what I mean?
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah.
How I interpreted that, mm-hmm. I just want basically for you to tell me that I'm correct.
Yeah, yeah,
that
yeah,
I interpreted
yeah.
it is that the sort of the point of the book to me is that sort of the brief sort of transcendental experiences that you can have simply by meeting someone who sees you for who you are.
Yes. Yes.
And Penelope goes through that with Charlotte, and she lives this like long murky life of 18 years of never really being seen or understood, and then she suddenly meets someone, and it's like she comes online for the first time, and mm-hmm. she just wakes up, and then she finds out through Aunt Claire and her late father that, I don't know, all the characters around her have had these brief touching spark points as well, and their lives have been made transcendent. I don't know, would you say that's an accurate reading of the book?
Absolutely. And about the fact that it can be a fleeting moment that can then have a profound effect on the rest of your life. I think that's exactly it. And I think I wanted, for example, the initial meeting between Penelope and Charlotte to be by chance. And I like the idea of these things, these events happening by...
And the chance echoes through
by chance, and that chance then echoing through, yeah. Because that's life as well.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly right. It's about the people being able to be themselves with the right people.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah.
And that being this thing that just lights them from within.
Yes, exactly.
We spoke about Daphne du Maurier a little bit before we started recording, and I mentioned that... Talitha,
but you can call her Talitha. Talitha is also fine.
How she's kind of like my cousin Rachel, if Rachel kept on living and had to deal with the admin of a large house.
Yes.
But another bit whereby it reminded me of du Maurier was Penelope is an unreliable narrator from the sense that she sees herself as being this plain nothing.
Yes.
But actually, the way people perceive her is deeply different.
Yes.
Which reminds me a lot of reading Rebecca the first time. You think she's this plain kind of teenager.
Yes.
And then you realise the way people are speaking to her, that like, not everyone can just go to Monte Carlo find a rich widower. And at one point he says to her, like, oh, your last name is very exotic, just like you. And you wonder, well, who is this person really?
But I read something about Daphne du Maurier, that because obviously Rebecca is one of the greatest studies of jealousy ever.
Oh, yeah.
Ever written. And apparently when she was writing that book, I think she was casting herself in both roles.
Yeah.
I think she was both the narrator and Rebecca.
Because that's sort of like boyishness to the kind of outdoorsy ruggedness of Rebecca, and the earthiness to her, I think, is definitely how Maurier saw herself.
Yes, and of course she was exotic, and of course she was charismatic, and of course she was all these things. But I think in the face of jealousy, she saw herself shrinking, and she became this inwardly what she was, you know, what she projects in the book is how she is. But actually, I think it's a really interesting point about that book is that she isn't that person.
Yeah.
And that's her view of herself. And in a way, that's exactly, gosh, that's so interesting that you pick that up about Penelope, because, you know, the whole point of her is that she's got to have, that there is something amazing about her.
It's not just that she's young and she has a nice house.
No, you know? but she's always taken the view that Inigo looks like their mother. And her mother was the great beauty. And also that the mother has very, very gradually over the years chipped away at Penelope in terms of, and not even really wanting to, not necessarily in a horrible, malicious way, but she doesn't like the fact that there could be any kind of rival to her beauty. Mm. And so she has made her daughter feel not as beautiful as she is, or made her feel like there's no sort of competition, I suppose. And that makes her sound really like a not a nice character, and I always really loved Talitha, but I think she's unbelievably flawed, and one of her flaws is that she had her daughter incredibly young, and she wasn't quite able to process how it felt, because I think she was jealous of her daughter because her daughter got the affection of her husband, and I think for a lot of women who have children when they're young and maybe with a man who they really deeply in love with, I think that's a difficult thing, which isn't explored that much, and actually isn't explored much in the book, because obviously we don't hear much about Penelope's father. But if we get to a point of lost art coming into a different form or medium, then that will be.
Perhaps a film?
Perhaps a TV?
No.
Possibly.
Is that being spoken about, or are you just...
I'm genuinely not sure if I'm supposed to say.
Oh, God.
But yes.
Okay, well, let's talk about... this is always the fun bit. Let's talk about... dream casting.
Mm-hmm.
The most fun.
Well, yes, I it changes me so much. I have I mean, Harry was always my kind of my David Bowie-ish, which obviously, yes, you know, in that kind of very almost David Bowie before when he was in kind of mid 60s to late 60s, so unbelievably early Bowie, that look. And then Rocky, I always felt he was my absolute classic George Clooney in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That was
right.
I mean, obviously not the character, but that sort of that American.
Just charisma fizzles around in the air then.
Yes. Like. And the whole point of him was his representation of the dream version of America.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I always had that very clearly in mind of him. And the girls is so strange because for me, Charlotte was such a direct mix in her looks between two of my close friends that I've almost found it impossible to get that out of my head.
Really?
It's hard to think of her in any other way other than how I built her in my imagination. But, yeah, I think... And Penelope the same in a weird way. I find them
the hardest to cast in my head as well.
I always wanted them both to be tall because I felt like fiction often is... Well, you don't often get fictional heroines who are very tall. It's just...
We were talking about this in the main episode, yeah, where we love that they're both tall. But generally, it's like one is tall and blonde and one is short and brunette, and it's all very formulaic. But yeah, I love how these two sort of like 5'10" girls going around London together, like quite broad-shouldered, and you get the sense that there's meat on their bones.
And they're quite young, because food was the other thing, was that at that time it was post-war and people weren't, you know, hadn't been able to eat whatever they wanted.
Yes.
And so I wanted Charlotte to be constantly... you know, foraging for food in the larder when she came to stay at Magna and just have this sense of her always wanting to eat and kind of going for the Aunt Claire's teas and, you know, discussing food all the time. It was a really big part of it for me.
I can imagine that you went through so many different, you know, crossing outs and rewrites of what exact food they're eating, because it's always perfect. What is a ginger scone? I don't know, but it's perfect.
Well, I just imagine it being a
did you make it up?
With ginger in. No, I've had them before. And they had little kind of nuggets of actual proper ginger in there.
Oh, right.
So that's how it was. Absolutely delicious.
Sounds great.
Yeah. But the food is by far the most fun part of life. Always. Food and clothes.
Oh, yeah. And you have a... It's just so sensorial, the whole thing. It's just a boring word to use, but...
No. Well, I'm so utterly thrilled that you think so. And, I really hope that it's going to be coming to light in a different...
In a different format, different medium. Fantastic. Well, yeah. I won't keep you any longer, but this has been a brilliant interview.
And
my first interview with one of the authors, so I hope they're all this good. To be honest.
Oh, gosh. Well, I haven't done an interview on Lost Art for so long that I had to kind of crank my brain into gear a bit.
Yeah, what's it like we're talking about a book that you wrote 13 years ago?
Well, because
the length of a teenager's life.
It was reprinted, and yeah, exactly. My daughter's 13 now.
Wow.
Yeah, and she's read it. Which is the
best
thing.
Does she
love it? She loves it, and it's so adorable. But she's quite a harsh critic, and she reads a lot. And she was so nice about it that I felt like, okay, job done. She likes it.
That's validation. 13 years later.
That will do. Yeah, exactly. But because I've been working on a script for it, it feels quite fresh in my head in that sense that the actual story.
That's great. Yeah.
But discussing it in terms of, you know, of the actual thought behind it is I haven't done for a while. It's really nice.
Thanks, Dave O'Rice, for talking to me, and thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of Sentimental Garbage, where I chat to Lucy Vine about Watermelon by Marion Keyes. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast produced by Hannah Varrell.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.